justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in session.
Good morning. You may be seated. The first case on our calendar is 07-1628, Genevieve DiCenzo versus A Best Products Company. Ms. Antonoon.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'm Ruth Antonoon on behalf of Appellant George V. Hamilton Incorporated. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I will divide the 12 minutes of my principal argument equally with counsel for amici, Attorney Marvin Karp. The issue before the court is whether this court's landmark decision in Temple versus Wien, in which this court adopted section 402A of the Restatement Second of Torts, applies retroactively to entities that were not the manufacturers of products. There are two aspects to this issue. First, what is the standard that is to be applied for determining retroactivity? And that's the issue that I will be addressing. And second is the application of that standard in order to determine retroactivity of Temple as it relates to suppliers.
Counsel, your brief and the briefs lay out all the equitable reasons why it should be prospective in nature. Let's go back to Lonsric,
okay.
The seminal case on products.
Yes.
Was that limited in its application to prospective?
I believe that it was, Your Honor, especially if you look at the Chevron Oil versus Houston standard for determining retroactivity, and that standard is a three. Well,
did this court say that Lonsric was prospective only?
The court did not specifically say whether it was.
What I'm troubled by with the general argument is that I thought all of the cases that we decided, or perhaps for any court for that matter, if it's not appealed, it is as if that was always the law. Isn't that the general rule?
That is, in fact, the general rule, but this court has always recognized that blind adherence to that rule is not mandated.
Right. But, and we have applied the sunburst doctrine because that's really what you're asking us to do to Temple versus Wien, isn't it? Is to say
that it applies prospectively.
And that's the sunburst doctrine, isn't it?
With regard to non-manufacturing defendants,
yes. Isn't that the sunburst doctrine?
The Summers
doctrine.
Doctrine. I've heard it referred to more as a Chevron Oil or.
Well, but going back to the Sunburst case.
Sunburst, yes.
The U.S. Supreme Court said states are free.
States are free, exactly.
To make it prospective only if they choose to do that.
Correct.
And we have on occasion done that. But if we don't do that specifically in a case, then it is as if it was always the law. Isn't that the general rule?
That is the general rule, but I think that there can be exceptions to that rule, and that's why we need to have a standard.
I understand, but you're asking us now to go back to a 1977 case and apply the sunburst doctrine today to the 77 case.
Yes. Because up until this point in time, Your Honor, there has been no decisions by this court saying that Temple versus Wien is retroactive or not retroactive with regard to non-manufacturing defendants. So it's an issue of first impression in this court, even though the Temple decision does go back to 1970.
Well, let me take you to another example. This court got into a lot of trouble, and I was part of the majority that caused that with an automobile case known as Ponzer.
Yes, Your Honor.
We would have had a lot less trouble if we would have said the sunburst doctrine applies. Didn't occur to me, maybe didn't to others, I don't know, that there was a 15-year tail in terms of statute of limitations. So it opened up a whole bunch of cases. Now, nobody came here and argued after we announced that gee, you ought to now make it prospective, you know, in a later case. I'm not sure that we can do that constitutionally.
Your Honor, I think you can do it constitutionally, and I think many other state courts have. In fact, the majority of the state courts who have looked at whether to use the Chevron oil standard versus the Harper standard have opted for
Let's
Chevron.
Take that example. Eventually, Gladys, written by Justice O'Connor, came along. We announced that. Didn't say anything about whether it's prospective only. And then Gladys was used by this court to reach back and undo decisions that were made in cases on declaratory judgments, but the case hadn't gone to trial yet, and say, you know, Ponzer's gone. And that's just the way it works, doesn't it, on every case? Once the case is announced, it's good law, and it can go back as far as the eye can see.
I think that there can be exceptions to that rule, and that especially in areas that of evolving areas of the law, such as when you look at products liability back in the mid-20th century, you have an evolving area of the law where new principles of law are announced.
Okay, and that's I have advocated the use of being prospective in nature, but you do it in that case. You do it in the principal case, don't you? This would be the first time where we're asked to go back and now apply, 30 years later, a determination as to it will be prospective only.
Your Honor, courts of appeal in Ohio typically are using, in fact, uniformly are using the Chevron oil standard in determining retroactivity of decisions. And there have been other decisions by the courts of appeal, most definitely, saying that certain announcements of this court are not to be applied retrospectively. I see that my 6 minutes have expired, and I'm going to actually
allow quickly, didn't they?
Pardon?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Karp.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. I'm delighted to have this opportunity to speak directly to the court this morning. One reason being that some 43 years ago, in 1965, I had the privilege of arguing Inglis against American Motors before this court. And since I'm probably the only person in this room who remembers that, I would remind the court that Inglis was part of a trilogy of cases decided by this court, in which this court, step by step, articulated the circumstances under which a manufacturer of a defective product could be held liable to an ultimate consumer in the absence of privity, those three cases being Rogers against Tony Home Permanent, Inglis against American Motors, and Laundrick against Republic.
Counsel, in any of those cases, did this court say prospective only?
No, it did not, Your Honor. And Mr. Justice Pfeiffer, I would respond differently to your question about Laundrick. Of course Laundrick was retrospective. Of course Laundrick was retroactive, no question about it. But that's the whole point of the Chevron oil test, because of the fact is two reasons. One, the party before Laundrick was a manufacturer, and they were being held clearly retrospectively liable, because when they did their wrongful act, they sold the defective steel, no one knew that this rule wasn't in effect. But it was foreshadowed, because when this court decided Laundrick, the concept of what this court called implied warranty and tort, which we now know as strict liability and tort, was pretty prevalent throughout the country. And Laundrick lists all these cases in which that doctrine was enforced. So that was no reason that Laundrick could not be retrospective. Temple against Wien, on the other hand, the language in Temple against Wien, which wasn't even applied to the parties before it, is different. It was introduced, the whole concept.
Okay, and I understand, and I think you've all done a good job of explaining why it's not fair, why it's inappropriate to apply Temple versus Wien to the Sellers. Where have we ever gone back to an old case and said, Now we're going to decide it's prospective only.
The one case that it comes immediately to mind, Mr. Justice, would be the case of Copperwell Steel against Lindley. It is cited in our reply brief. And in that case, this court announced a new rule in interpreting a statute, a taxation statute, sales and use, I believe. And in connection with that, the issue before the court in Copperwell was whether or not that prior decision should be limited in its terms of its retroactive effect. And in so holding that it should be, this court took into account the concern that had been expressed by the legislature with respect to its prior decision. And the legislature was concerned about it. It says, we are going to very drastically limit the retroactive effect of this case. That's one example. But the situation, I'm familiar with the cases in which this court says, yes, this case shall be deemed to be prospective only. And recently, what, the Minster Steel case just a couple months ago said that. But we're dealing with a situation where no one thinks about it at the time. Temple against Wien being a great example, no one even realized you were holding Sellers liable.
But if we do what you're asking us to do here, then in every case that we announce, are we going to have to go through this analysis?
Absolutely not.
And decide and write about, is this prospective or retroactive?
No one's saying that, but what we're saying is there are situations that occur when after a decision has come down, and you look at the ramifications to other people, as you stated in Minster. Look at the ramifications, then the court can say, wait a minute, should we limit retroactivity in this? And then rather than saying, well, we flip a coin, maybe we should, maybe we shouldn't, we are saying Chevron Oil gives this court and the other courts a test to apply in that situation. When you look at it years afterwards and say, wait a minute, should this be retroactive or not?
Now, here's the test. My final question on this is, so we do what you're advocating, we do it today, apply it to a 77 case.
Right.
Are there no constitutional issues with respect to rights that have vested in between time? In other words, can we do that and affect the people you want to affect without any other constitutional issues, or could we only do it going forward? The Temple versus Wien only applies or does not apply from this day forward.
I suppose that all of us could perhaps think of a peculiar fact situation where that might be impacted. My answer would be, in general, no. The test utilized, the Chevron Oil Company test, which is utilized by not only had been by the Supreme Court, but by state courts across the country, has applied that, 30 years? No one seems to think there was a great problem in doing so. I'm willing to concede there may be a particular situation would be unfair, and you say, wait, we can't do it here. But in the general rule, which I think what this court is looking for, and what we're urging here is continued viability of Chevron Oil, and insofar as this particular situation is concerned, the imposition of strict liability on Sellers in 1977, where it came out of the blue. Never had happened before, and nobody even realized for another 8 years that is what the impact of simply adopting the language of Section 242A as a replacement for implied warranty and tort. In that situation, it falls squarely within Chevron Oil, and the retroactivity should not be applied insofar as we're talking about non-manufacturer sellers of defective products.
Mr. Karp, how does the Harper case impact the Chevron?
Which case is that?
Harper versus Virginia.
Harper is the decision by Justice Thomas, the United States Supreme Court, in which they take this hard-line view, which essentially says every case is retrospective. Every case is retroactive. And that's a hard and very simple test to apply. We submit that most of the state Supreme Courts that have looked at Harper since that time have said, we don't like it, we prefer Chevron. And Chevron makes sense because it allows the court to take into account these special situations. It doesn't happen every day, but the situations that come along where it's patently unfair and unjust to apply a particular decision to other people, retrospectively, in that situation, if you meet the Harper test, you don't do it. And we think that's a much fairer test rather than a simple line that everything is retrospective, unless the court specifically says in that decision, this court is only prospective. Does that answer your question, Your Honor? Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Karp. Mr. Rhodes.
May it please the court, I'm David Bennett Rhodes, and I'm here for the appellee, Genevieve DiCenzo. Ordinarily, Your Honors, this court sits to correct errors by the lower courts. In the present case, the intermediate appellate court
That wouldn't be correct, would it?
In the present case, the intermediate appellate court applied the very clear mandate of this court in the Lakeside and Bosch cases that if the opinion does not say it's prospective only, then it is retrospective. The court below was bound to do that. It can hardly be said to have erred. So the question then becomes, is this case one that presents compelling circumstances for this court to change the rules and make it that its decisions are open for second guessing as to whether they should be prospective or retrospective, or make it that this court always has to say for the guidance of lower courts rather than having the handy rule that if it doesn't say that it's prospective, then it's retrospective. I submit, Your Honor, that it's clearly a good rule to have, the rule in Lakeside, because it's a very rare case in which the court will not apply the ruling to the parties before it. Let's take Temple, for example. It's being said that Temple did not involve a non-manufacturing seller. In point of fact, one of the defendants before this court in Temple was General Motors, which was not the manufacturer of the punch press. This court adopted Section 402A. It then analyzed General Motors' liability under the standards of 402A. It happened that General Motors was found not to be liable because there hadn't been a defect in the machine that caused the injury, and there had been an alteration in the use by the user. But nevertheless, the new rule was applied to the parties before the court. Harper does not specifically preclude states from applying the Chevron test. But the fact that many courts have applied the Chevron test is a little misleading, because courts have not applied the Chevron test to determinations of a higher court, which is what the lowest court did in this case. The Chevron test is a guide for a court that is considering whether to apply its decision prospectively or retrospectively, what factors it should consider in making that determination. That's for this court to do when this court announces a new rule. In Temple, this court did not do so. Now, the question was asked here, is this the first time that the court has been asked to go back and make a prior ruling prospective 30 years later when it wasn't prospective in the original ruling? And the answer was given that the Copperweld case cited in the amici reply brief was such a case. In fact, as is disclosed in that brief, Copperweld was looking at the effect of a prior case, the OAMCO case, that was expressly limited to prospective application and was looking at what effect it would have. So it is not a case, and it's still, this would be the first time ever in the research that we've found where any court has gone back and made an earlier decision retrospective. Now, I think it goes beyond that, Your Honors. What this court is being asked to do is truly extraordinary. All of the arguments about the merits, the Chevron factors that have been made before this court in the briefs are equally applicable to the case of manufacturers, except possibly the extent to which manufacturers and suppliers would anticipate the change in the rule, although, as I will hope to address shortly, there's not really a difference there. This was a foreshadowed decision. But nevertheless, most of those arguments, if not all of them, apply just as strongly to the case of manufacturers. Manufacturers could just as well have said, applying Lonsdrick to my pre-1966 conduct is unfair. And yet, no court in the entire country, among the dozens of states' highest courts that have adopted strict liability in the evolution of product liability law, no court has ever limited it to prospective only application.
Counsel, isn't there a distinction between the manufacturer of a defective product and the supplier of the defective product? And when we're talking about the ability to conform one's conduct to what's expected by the law, isn't there really a distinction between the two?
Well, Your Honor, there is, and there more particularly is in a negligence cause of action, which is not at issue here. But for strict liability purposes, there's not much of a distinction because they sold the same product. And in strict liability, the focus is on the product, not on the fault of the party. And so when we talk about the ability of a manufacturer or a seller to conform its conduct, we're almost introducing fault principles into strict liability. They both sold the same product, and the conduct that the law is talking about for them is either not selling a defective product or spreading the risk of that defective product through market forces.
Counsel, could the legislature, because there's some discussion of the enactments in the 80s on product liability, and I believe what went on then was a general agreement between a whole bunch of interests to codify the common law of this state, not to really change it in any respect. But say the legislature decided we don't think sellers should ever have to face strict liability. They could do that, couldn't they?
Yes, they could, Your Honor, going forward, prospectively. And in fact, Your Honor, they almost did so. In the supplier statute, they severely curtailed the ability of an injured plaintiff to bring a strict liability claim against a non-manufacturing supplier unless the manufacturer is not available. There's been some disagreement between these parties in the lower courts about the meaning of that.
And they could go even further. They could just say, we don't think sellers should have to face strict liability.
They could indeed do that, but they have not. The point is they could not do it retrospectively because the Constitution of Ohio forbids retrospective legislation. And the parties in this case agreed in the trial court that the supplier statute did not apply to these cases even though they were filed after its effective date because it concerned conduct that happened before the date of that statute. What's happening here is that this court is being asked to fill a gap and make the legislation retroactive by going back to its own 1977 decision and saying that it will apply only prospectively so that the gap between the conduct before 1977 is essentially absolved of strict liability, giving an effect that the legislature could not have.
Aren't we being asked to do a little more than that? Aren't we being asked to take it beyond the statute, because under the statute, sellers could still be on the hook if the manufacturer's gone or not available, right?
That's quite true, Your Honor. It is even more than the statute.
But if we're to say Temple versus Ween, there's no strict liability, period, for sellers, that goes beyond the statute even, doesn't
Clearly,
it?
Yes, Your Honor, it does. Your Honor, I'd like to address for a minute the effect of the Harper case on the Chevron factors. Harper overruled Chevron insofar as Chevron indicated, in particular, that lower courts could second-guess the prospective or retrospective application of the Supreme Court's decisions. And I think by analogy, it would be appropriate for this court to take to not take a kindly view of trial courts deciding that this court's pronouncements of the law won't apply to the cases before the trial court that come into court after the announcement of that rule.
You believe that that Harper overrules the law of Chevron, the test to be applied in Chevron?
It doesn't overrule the test. The test is a prudential test, and a number of courts have applied that. When it is appropriate for a court to analyze prospective or retrospective application of a law, the Chevron factors are a useful guide to make that analysis. But what Harper says is that the law may not be permitted to shift and spring according to a court's perceptions of the equities of a particular litigant whether he relied on a prior rule or could foresee it. And this is precisely the situation that Harper is talking about. At least four times the intermediate appellate courts in this state, in reliance on Temple, have applied strict liability to suppliers. And those cases are done. And now this court's being asked to come back and say that wasn't the law all along, and because now we're looking at the equities of a different set of litigants, we think that it's not fair to do it, and we're going to change the rule going back to there. That's precisely the shifting and springing of the law, of the common law, based on the circumstances of particular litigants that so troubled the Supreme Court. And I believe there is a constitutional dimension to that. They did not specifically say that it would violate equal protection as guaranteed in the Constitution of the United States and also guaranteed in Ohio's Constitution. But what they did say is that their decision was dictated by principles of equal treatment of similarly situated litigants. And that is a grave concern in this case, because over those 30 years, the law in Ohio has in fact been that suppliers are strictly liable at common law. Your Honor, I would like to commend to the court's reading, in particular from the Harper case, because there's multiple opinions in there. The opinion of Justice Scalia in concurrence, because he lays out the history of the understanding of retrospectivity, and I think that it's very informative. He points out, though, that the traditional view is that prospective decision-making is quite incompatible with the judicial power and that courts have no authority to engage in the practice. Now, that's not the law. The whole court didn't say courts can never do it, and the Supreme Court has not said this court may not do prospective only legislation. It is, according to Justice Scalia, the handmaiden of judicial activism. It's a double-edged sword. It's something that can be used for somebody that wants to tinker with the law in ways that are different from tradition. But, Your Honors, that is a something that the states remain free under Supreme Court precedent to do. But I would suggest that this goes well beyond what the Supreme Court has said that courts can do. A state Supreme Court, in announcing a new rule, can, based on the equities of the situation, make that new rule prospective only. But that's not what's being asked for here. What's being asked for here is for this court to go back and revisit a rule that was made 30 years ago and was not prospective only, and make it prospective only in retrospect. And that is a unique thing that's never been done in the annals of American jurisprudence. It raises serious concerns about the judicial role, about equal protection, and about fundamental fairness. Your Honor, I'd like to turn now to talk about those Chevron factors in case this court is inclined to accept the invitation to rebalance those factors and decide an issue that should have been decided and implicitly was decided in 1977 as to whether this should be prospective only. The first test is whether the decision is one that is a new rule that's not clearly foreshadowed. I submit, Your Honor, that when the Temple case said that the cause of action adopted in Lonsdrich is virtually indistinguishable from Section 402A and from the cause of action that it applied, virtually indistinguishable means the same thing as clearly foreshadowed. It's not the case that with this emerging product liability law and the gradual evolution of it and so forth, when the courts abandoned the requirement of privity, it clearly signaled that a seller, even a non-manufacturing seller, could expect that the privity defense would be gone and he would be liable for an implied warranty for the product he sold. Traditionally, a seller warrants his products, and if you don't have to have privity, then the seller, whether manufacturer or not, would be a warrantor, and that's the cause of action adopted in Lonsdrich. This is merely a new application of an existing rule in Temple. It is not a new rule that was not foreshadowed, that they could hardly expect, that was out of the blue, as counsel has described it. The second factor in view of time, I'd like to skip to the third factor, whether this is manifestly unfair. There's been a lot of point made that we're letting people in for liability when they couldn't have gotten insurance, that probably you're going to bankrupt people, you're going to have new suits. This defendant is a Pennsylvania corporation that's from McKees Rocks near where I live. Pennsylvania law clearly had supplier liability at the time of the acts in question. It's preposterous to think that they did their conduct differently on a job site in Ohio from what they did in Pennsylvania. Moreover, they do have insurance. They studiously avoided saying to the court, we don't have insurance, so risk spreading doesn't apply, because it's not true. And I see that my time is virtually up, and I would therefore conclude. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Ms. Antone, you've saved just about a minute of your time, a little less.
Thank you. I'd like to speak about Harper and its application or non-application to Temple. The touchstone of Harper, can only be utilized even on its own test if the court had, the prior decision had been applied to the parties before the court. That didn't happen in Temple. This court did not say in Temple a seller is liable for under strict liability. It is true there are a number of sellers in the chain of the defendants. One can go through the record of that case and with great difficulty try to figure out what the theory is against the various defendants, including General Motors, including another intermediate seller, et cetera. But this court in Temple did not say that under the rule that we are approving today, that a seller, General Motors or X, is liable.
I thought the court adopted the restatement in Temple.
Simply it did, absolutely. And then it went on and said, we adopt this, but in this particular case, we don't even apply it because of the fact is that the problem was due to the
if they adopted the restatement, then they said, hence, the sellers are liable on strict liability.
The fact is that was the idea of strict liability of a seller was so foreign that the courts of this state went 8 years before they realized that that language was even in there. It took the decision of this court in Bacchione against Ralston Perina in 1985, 8 years later, to finally say, hey, lower courts, 402A covers a seller. No one realized it. It was
done. Well, now, that there wasn't a case doesn't necessarily mean that no one realized it.
I'm sorry?
That there wasn't a Supreme Court case doesn't necessarily mean that no one realized it in the practice.
Went through two levels of courts, Your Honor.
Wouldn't you assume that knowledgeable and skilled lawyers who read Temple advise their clients strict liability applies to you?
Well, I would agree that knowledgeable lawyers who read it would have said that, but we had the Common Pleas Court of Cuyahoga County, we had a Court of Appeals for Cuyahoga County that said, hey, this situation, there is no strict liability on seller. This court took jurisdiction of it and said, look at the language says it applies to seller.
So this court said, read Temple versus...
But that was the first time it was introduced in Ohio law. So the counsel talks about foreshadowing. Where was this foreshadowed? No one had any idea this was part of the law, and therefore it didn't apply it. Certainly it didn't apply it on its facts. Harper doesn't apply. And Harper itself recognizes that since you have to have that rule applied to the parties before it, there are situations in which a rule announced by the highest court in a jurisdiction would be not retroactive. The court can look at it. We say Chevron Oil gives you that test in this situation.
Your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Karp. Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.